Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we are joined by Dr. Ping Du. Ping is an assistant professor in modern English and literary linguistics at the School of Education and English. Ping's expertise is in research and business executive training in intercultural workplace communication. Her research incorporates theories and methods from pragmatics, social linguistics, and cross-cultural psychology.
A lot of long words there.
There's some big words there. And I will say I'm also very old friends with Ping, so I'm very pleased to have her here. I've admired her work for quite a while. She's working with authentic, interactive, and ethnographic data, such as interviews, field observation notes, and various organizational documents. And her current research interests include disagreement strategies, identity construction, and cultural othering and prejudice in intercultural conflict interactions. And one thing I've really been fascinated by in her work is the idea of miscommunication or where communication goes wrong. So that's good fun.
Oh, I'm looking forward to discussing
it. It's kind of like us too.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Like, do you think we actually communicate or do we just kind of constantly just kind of snipe?
We talk at each other.
Talk over each other, at each other.
Yeah. Not through each other, luckily.
Moving on.
In January 2022, Ping published the paper Shared Laughter as Relational Strategy at Intercultural Conflict Workplace Interactions in the Journal of Pragmatics. Now, I feel a little bit intimidated here because I am surrounded by two people from the School of Education and English here, both of whom know what all of these long words actually mean, in a sense. And me, I'm looking at this paper and I'm just thinking, whoa, laughter, communication. That's really interesting.
What? You're right. It is really interesting.
What does it all mean?
So the Journal of Pragmatics is a great one. And,
okay.
And pragmatics is essentially the idea of what we mean by what we say in a very holistic way.
Okay, so you mean in the sense that there's a sort of another meaning behind what we say and we do in sort of communication situations?
Absolutely, yeah. So
humans
are very complex and communication is very complex. And so very often things like verbal irony, for example.
So when I say stuff like, you know, like, well, Derek's really old.
No, that's a very surface level.
What's going on beneath that?
I think you're pragmatically implying that you wish me to die very shortly. And then you can do your podcast on your own.
Okay. All right. All of the people in the room are now trying to stifle their laughter, right? Especially the intern who's recording this.
You're allowed to laugh at me too. Don't worry.
Okay. I guess reading this, I did not realize how much, because I've now been very conscious about this, how much I laugh as a form of communication. I've discovered I actually do that a lot. And since reading this, I'm like, whoa, like, what does that actually mean? How am I using that? I mean, am I trying to be funny? I don't think I'm trying to be funny, but I'm sort of filling a lot of conversational gaps and a lot of interactions with that, you know, as a sort of method, I guess, to make things smoother. And Ping's research here is kind of confirming that and saying that's something that a lot of people do.
Absolutely. So one of the interesting things, of course, in laughter study is that it's very often not used in response to humor or as a part of humor at all. And that's essentially what Du Ping is saying here. Although I don't want to speak for you. You're here to help us out to understand this.
She laughed awkwardly.
Well, we're one of the cool things about this is I didn't really think about this very much either, because it's metalinguistic or it's paralinguistic, right? So laughter essentially sits outside of the normal realm of what we would cover in linguistics, does it not?
Welcome, Ping. Do tell us about your research.
So maybe what we can start with is if you can give us a summary of this particular paper and perhaps its contributions to the field, and then we'll ask you a few questions about it. I have lots.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much for having me here. I'm so excited when I received the invitation. And also, I'm so happy to be able to talk about my research here and with you and also for
the audience. Well, you really are a specialist in intercultural communication. That was completely the right thing to say. Thank you so much.
This article was actually, I started to notice this phenomenon when I was looking at my meeting data collected in a multicultural workplace in China. And my focus when I went to collect the data and study the workplace was on, as Derek said, misunderstanding and also conflict, conflictual interactions and what caused misunderstanding and how do people interact in the conflictual meetings and how do they resolve the conflict. But when I was listening to the meetings, there was one phenomenon that constantly attracted my attention. That was many of the meetings are highly conflictual and filled full of disagreement, but there are a lot of laughter, a lot of instances of laughter in these meetings. And very often, for example, this one meeting, I just selected one meeting because there are so many meetings and so many interesting examples. And in the end, I had to focus on one just to look at this case study and what actually was happening. And then this is probably one of the most conflictual meeting, and you probably have seen in the article there are many instances of shared laughter. It means people laughing together, or one person laughs and then other people join him or her. That is definition of shared laughter. So I started to wonder why. Usually laughter is associated with fun, isn't it? With happiness, with humor.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. If I think of any meetings I've been in where there is disagreement or there is sort of tension for whatever reason, there's definitely laughter there.
Isn't it? Yes. Yeah, I observed that in my own workplace and other workplaces I worked in as well. That's very interesting, isn't it? So my interest as a researcher in pragmatics was, what is the function of it? That is the question, more technical question behind why do people laugh, isn't it? Yeah, what are they doing by sharing the laughter in the process of conflict? Sometimes really unpleasant, confrontational interactions.
Is this specifically always an intercultural situation that you study? Because that seems to be what you're very interested in.
Yeah, I started, and also these meetings, this workplace as well, is and are multicultural. But in this paper, I didn't really focus on culture in the traditional sense when people talk about cultural differences. I did wonder, though, whether it be the same, you will see this similar phenomena in other, for example, in British workplace meetings or American workplace meetings. But definitely I've seen this in many multicultural meetings in the Chinese workplace context. But because this is a case study, I wasn't able to make any generalization.
Yeah, I understand that, the data was part of a much larger set. Is that correct? And you picked one very specific example from that to look at it closely and to see how laughter functioned in this very sort of conflictual workplace situation.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us about that process a little bit?
The process of the conflict and how the role of laughter in it. Yeah. Generally speaking, my conclusion or my findings, the first set of findings is, what is the role of shared laughter? What do they, what are people doing when they share laughter? I found three functions in the process of conflict interaction. One is when shared laughter is used as aligned attack. That happens when one person makes very often a sarcastic comment and also started to laugh, indicate you can join me to laugh at this. I just performed a sarcasm. And another person who shares or who actually affiliate with the stance of the speaker also join the laughter. And then they share the laughter. But the thing is, the comment was an attack, a face attack in the politeness concept. Actually, the comment performed a face attack on the other participants in the meeting.
That sounds really unpleasant.
That's what conflict is about, isn't it?
So sorry, can we just take a couple of steps back? Because our audience might not understand, because there's the traditional Chinese cultural notion of face.
Mm.
But what you're using is the kind of pragmatic notion of face in terms of both positive and negative face, right? Which I've always actually found a bit of a difficult name. Not the positive face seems to make sense. And actually negative face makes sense as well, but it's not really negative. Both of them have to do with wants. Mm. So I've always considered the labeling of these things to be a little bit difficult or just not. But maybe you can explain to us the idea of face in this linguistic sense.
Yeah, you mentioned the Chinese concept of face, isn't it? That was basically that was where the face concept, the linguistic concept of face came from. It was introduced to the Western academia in 1944 by Hu and picked up by Goffman later. And then Bronte Levinson picked that up again from Goffman. The Chinese face concept extremely complicated. And it involves a face, a social game, for example. I pay you face and you pay face back. I do this. And so it involves a lot of social exchange of resources and things like that. Bronte Levinson's face, positive, negative face. I always wondered why they call it positive face, negative face. So when I was teaching, I usually tell students you could just call it A face and a B face.
That because, to me is more, is simpler to then conceptualize.
I guess they call it positive face because it's very often when people talk about positive face refers to the positive self-image people want to claim for themselves. For example, in the workplace, people want to be considered as competent. People want to be considered as nice, kind, and things like that. All the positive
most people.
Attribute. As a psychological need, I guess, I would think probably everybody wants it, no? Wants to be considered as, want to be connected or related to all these positive attributes. Maybe that's why they call it positive face. Negative face then involves the claim of the boundary. The protection of one's possession, including, for example, time and space and the want of not being imposed on, not being distracted, the want of mind one's own business. So these are Bronte Levinson's face, and these concepts have been criticized a lot by researchers, especially researchers from China and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
One argument was, for example, researchers in Japan and China, was that, seems in, the Eastern Asian societies, there wasn't this need of a negative face in social interactions. Definitely you see a lot of instances or strategies that address other people's positive face need. How much you liked, right? But very often very rare you see people try to draw the boundary. And it's because in Eastern Asian cultures, I have developed another set of theory based on cross-cultural psychology. I call it cultural self-perception to explain the issue of a boundary drawing in group self cultures or collectivist cultures. Basically, drawing a boundary is between friends. It's almost like saying, from now on, we are not friends anymore. So, but in negative face, in Brown Levinson's sense, it's negative political strategies. It's everyday, it's part of our everyday use. For example, even by saying, could you please pass me the water? That is addressing the other person's negative face need by indicating that I know you, maybe you don't want to be imposed on by this request. So I know you might have your own business to deal with. So by saying, could you please, I'm addressing your negative face need by using this mitigation or hedge. Mm-hmm. So this is Brown Levinson's framework, but their theory has been really attacked in the past, fiercely in the past 3 decades.
And it's not wholly necessary for what you're looking at in any case, because face threatening acts can apply to both of those types, right?
So yeah.
Anything that might threaten the autonomy or the image of the other can be considered generically these kind of face threatening acts. And I think what your paper is saying as well is very often when these take place, laughter can indicate either reconciliation ultimately or alignment. Or just broadly an affiliation. Is that correct? Mm.
Yeah, there are several dimensions there, isn't it? When laughter is used as a mitigation, when people realize they are performing a face-threatening act, or the activity they're performing, they know may cause face loss on the other person's they may fail, their face is threatened.
But it is fascinating, Duping. Sorry to interrupt, but the idea that because there are different perceptions of what constitutes a type of face, even if we don't use that word per se, but if there are impositions that are being made in, or threats being made to your image in conversation, there could be very different perceptions depending on your own cultural basis for that, yeah, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are definitely cultural differences, isn't there? In the perception of face loss, whether there is a face threat or not. Definitely. That's why the researchers have been criticizing Brown Levinson's theory. I used their concept like a face threatening act or face, but not strictly following their use, because that has been so long ago, isn't it? 1987. And also when Brown Levinson, when they look at politeness, their face concept lies at the foundation of their politeness theory. They basically were looking at utterances. I said one sentence in this context, that a face-threatening act is performed, and how that act is performed by using positive or negative face politeness strategies. But when we look at real life interaction, I noticed that relationship is not only managed at the utterance level. We also manage relationship at the turn-taking level and also at higher levels, for example, in the interactional process.
How do you observe those different levels? Because that must be very difficult. I mean, you're going to have to start filming things, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I guess one is because I'm working with real-life data. Brandon Levinson and other people, earlier researchers, they probably work with, they call it armchair.
Constructed example.
Yeah, constructed examples. So they think, in this context, people say, might say this. So they work with utterances out of the context. And,
I don't understand that.
Okay. So you. Derek,
No, jump in. This is great. Because I'm a functional linguist. So this is actually speaking exactly to some of the criticisms that our perspective has
functional
taken.
Functional as opposed to a non-functional linguist?
Well, I'm dysfunctional in other ways. But as a linguist, precisely what Duping is saying, that you look at language in its natural environment and its context, and then your theory has to explain that. So it's not about trying to have a theory that you make the data fit into, but that there's a dialogue between your theory and what you observe. And so, yeah, armchair linguist is an interesting way to put it. In many cases, if we were trying to prove a grammar point, for example, in a traditional sense, you would use an example that seems like something someone would say,
okay.
Right? So you construct an example that illustrates your point.
Yeah. For example, just now I said, could you please pass me the water? I said that sentence for the saying of saying it as because I needed a sentence as example to to show you something, but that was out of context.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the work that you do and that you did on this seems to be very kind of authentic and sort of ethnographic.
Ethnographic, yes. Definitely.
Okay.
My observation involves audio recordings of real workplace meetings.
Okay. So you don't sit in the meetings and observe?
Some of the meetings,
really?
Even because sometimes they're bilingual. With some of the meetings, I was the translator.
Okay.
But in some other meetings, I sat in, I think, three or four. Four maybe, but the rest of the meetings I didn't. The participants just took my recorder and go in the meetings and record, and they also can decide whether they want to give me the meeting or not after they finish the recording.
Which I'm impressed by, because when you're dealing with workplace conflict, there must be a bit of wanting to hide the conflicts in your workplace,
right? Slight embarrassment or want to cover up, don't want to remember that.
Oops, I deleted that file.
But
that's why this set of data is quite, I'm really, really lucky to be able to have this data set. For workplace research, getting access, I think, is the most difficult part, really.
How do you win that trust to be able to do that?
Basically, I got the data, of course, before I came here, when I was working on my PhD project. And during that process, I helped them to build their program. They wanted to build this program. Mm. So the CEO, basically, I helped him to even hire these participants in these meetings. For example, Vincent Jack, the international teaching managers, were actually hired by me. And also I worked with them for 1 year and a half. Together.
This is real dedication to the field. So we're there for a whole year.
But this also is ethnographic.
Mm-hmm. Participant observation, isn't it?
Yeah. And then you are an informed researcher, right? So you know the people involved.
Initially, when I helped them, especially the CEO who started this company, I wasn't planning to do anything. I wasn't planning to collect the data. I wasn't even planning to collect data in the workplace. I was still the initial stage thinking what to do. But it's multicultural workplace. I work on intercultural communication. And then I started to observe during that 1.5 years, started to observe a lot of problems in communication, even to the extent of open confrontations. So I thought, why not collect the data here? So when I asked them, they all agreed because they also want to understand why.
Sure.
Well, and good for them. And one of the strengths of the case study methodology actually is exactly that. You get a really deep dive, a really extensive understanding of a sliver. I mean, you talked before about one of the drawbacks is that it's not as generalizable. But at the same time, when you have that kind of rich data that is very, very explained, then you can at least see echoes of that in other situations potentially. And you can kind of extrapolate general principles. You just have to be careful about it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. For that matter, of course, I would only draw a conclusion based on the evidence I have, isn't it? For example, in this article, I only draw the conclusion based on what was observed about shared laughter in this meeting. But if I want to make a more generalizable claim about shared laughter, I would need to observe more meetings, maybe in a different context, a workplace context, I want to, yeah.
Before you were outlining actually what you found, these three different kinds of laughter, was it? I'd really love to know what the other two are, actually.
Yeah, thank you. The other one, apart from the aligned attack, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the one that made me very uncomfortable. So I want to hear the ones that actually are going to make things better.
That was performed at the peak of the conflict, when it's most conflictual. But throughout the whole conflict process, from the beginning to the end, there was effort of the participants to mitigate the tension. That is why I said face is not the only relational concern I look at when I observe the functions of shared laughter. I also looked at I call it relational dynamics. That is the subjective assessment of the participants of how the interaction is going. Yeah, is it very tense? Is it friendly, unfriendly? And things like that. And so Dale Himes would call it key, or the tone of this interaction. Yeah. So then they use the shared laughter to mitigate the tension when they fail, when the participants. And here I focus on the audience. There are 14 participants, and most of them didn't speak, actually.
It was a big meeting.
Yeah.
I found this very interesting. I mean, in your article, you have kind of a sort of plan of where everyone was sitting, for instance. You know, you have a transcript of who's talking when. So it was extremely precise in this way.
Yeah, you mentioned precise. That is because I used the conversation analysis. Yeah, this actually was relevant to an earlier question you asked. How did I, but I can't remember exactly the question you asked, because I started talking about, I use real life data. Your question is about why I didn't focus on utterance, why I was able to actually look at the phenomenon in a larger or higher levels, isn't it, in the discourse?
Yes, from reading the paper, the example that you pulled out and that you closely looked at was part of a much wider data set, as I understand.
Yeah, okay. Data set of 21, actually more than 21, but I selected 21 meetings. In total, 39 hours in terms of the meetings.
Did you have to listen to 39 hours?
I have them transcribed.
Okay.
Yeah. Student interns helped a lot. Yeah. So, yeah, working
Thank
with...
Thank God for student interns.
Students are always very helpful. Yeah, so working with authentic data, looking at the real-life authentic interactions. But the other reason I was able to look at other levels, apart from the utterance level, was because I used conversation analysis. conversation analysis is a framework that is based on ESSEL methodology. That is again based on phenomenology in social sciences. So this conversation analysis as a framework, it looks at how the participants interact. And in this interaction, they co-construct a social reality. So it's really about the intersubjective construction of understanding and relationship. Mm-hmm. Here in my study, I'm interested in the co-construction of the relationship in a turn-by-turn interaction or context.
As I listen to you, Duping, I'm thinking that you are one of the most useful people I've ever met.
Certainly in this room.
Think for yourself. But the ideas and the data that you're coming up with is just so relevant right now. I feel like there could be an enormous, great, big global collapse and all of the economies would implode, but we'd still need Duping to be able to work, to be able to get along. There'd still be demand for you. I feel everything you're saying is so relevant. And one thing, actually, you were mentioning some of the previous studies that had been done and some of the theory and all of that. And when I was looking at a lot of the dates in your bibliography and your references, they tend to be sort of in the late 2000s, early 2000s, when I think these intercultural workplaces and these situations were starting to grow and people were starting to pay attention to this. So it feels like you are in an unbelievably useful field right now. And listening to you makes me slightly paranoid because I'm starting to kind of, you know, sort of self-analyze things like my posture and my tone and all the rest of it.
Yeah, one MA student, I remember many years ago, made a comment because I teach discourse analysis. So she said, we are all scared of you because we feel you can see through us. Yes, but actually it's not true because it's really tiring work. You have to apply all the transcribe data, having said that, when I attend very interesting meetings, I do get to analyze them. So sometimes you get sometimes in some meetings you feel quite
you're giving too much away. Don't tell them. They'll listen. They'll know what you're doing.
Yeah, but so usually people will start to analyze interactive behaviors when something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in smooth interactions like now, people don't analyze because people don't need to look for the reason why. In this meeting, it's because it's so conflictual that's why I analyzed it and wanted to find out why, what went wrong.
Mm. Yeah. I should plug one of the leaders of our field, Jim Martin, who has put forward the idea of positive discourse analysis. Ah. So instead of a kind of critical discourse analysis, I realize that's not what you're talking about per se here, but instead of focusing on imbalances or conflict or where communication is rough, sometimes we should use a really positive text in the sense that this one is beautiful. So in some ways, like stylistics looks at a very successful literary text and things like that. Mm. But this is really interesting because from my perspective as a functional linguist, you also have this really charged interpersonal element, right? Mm. So what we might call tenor at the upper levels. And it's fascinating to me the way that because you're focusing on the laughter, this is a non-experiential realm, right? Like laughter doesn't have real world meaning. Right. So it's not like, you know, when we analyze what cup is in a kind of semantic field or something like that. And you make this point really nicely. And I'll ask you this now in the form of a question. What are the advantages for laughter being fundamentally ambiguous?
Yeah, because it's ambiguous, then it can be used in very sensitive or troubled interactions when people fail. Because in very sensitive, for example, conflict or situations, it opens up the space for interpretation and also give people the opportunity to say, no, that is not what I meant.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't laughing at you. I was laughing with you.
Yeah.
Which are terms that you use in this paper as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes, language, but, inherently is ambiguous already.
Absolutely.
But laughter is even more ambiguous. So
it's primitive, right? Or sorry, yeah. in the sense it's like primate behavior, right? So we see calls and things of non-human primates,
yeah.
And these are also very often affiliative strategies or non. I mean, they do cross the boundaries, I think, sometimes in that they're indicative of real world elements. But laughter is not like that, is it?
Mm.
Or is it culturally specific? Because you did sort of touch upon this as its use as a relational strategy can be quite culturally specific, particularly in what you term problem talk.
Mm. Yeah, in terms of culture, there was in the intercultural communication literature, there was some observation that in Asian cultures, it seems people tend to laugh more or use laughter to deal with troubles.
Yeah.
I also observed some instances and sometimes it's quite obvious and awkward to people from different cultures because they didn't expect that. But I can't make generalization now because there isn't really, I haven't done any study. But in this study, in this one thing I really wanted to point out or maybe just to maybe remind you to look at, because it's so interesting, that is the role of the audience. You know, in Chinese workplace meetings or in Chinese workplace in general, hierarchy, esteem for hierarchy is a value, isn't it? It's the norm. So in this meeting, it is fairly formal. So the audience are all Chinese. They followed the norm, of course, and the norm, because their role is audience, they were not, they know they were not going to speak. But they also know, they also sense that there's tension, and tension is, basically exacerbated, more and more. So they wanted to help. How to help? So they started to do these shared laughter by a very intricate process, because sometimes the speaker, for example, Vincent, he made, maybe he was supposed to stop, but he wasn't stopped for the meeting translation. Then he used the awkward laughter. Basically, that laughter is to mitigate the fact that he made a mistake. And that could be interpreted as a face-threatening act because he didn't respect the right of the interpreter to translate the meeting, isn't it? So anyway, there's some slightly not very serious threat to the face. So he used mitigation laughter there. When he said, I realized, I'm supposed to stop, pause for translation. But at this moment, everybody started to laugh together with him. Normally, I wouldn't think that is something so funny that can cause such a large scale of shared laughter and so loud. Everybody in the meeting room was laughing.
Now, so, this is what you called a metacommunicative laughable, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that this is a signal of the entire communication situation,
yeah,
instead of the kind of meat of the communication itself,
yeah,
right?
It's nothing to do with the content, what is said. Because what is said, what was said by the speaker was quite face-threatening because he was talking about problems. And who are responsible for the problems? The many people in the audience. Yeah, because in that case, Vincent is international manager and... obviously for him.
These are the people in the conflict meeting that you're
Yes. So basically it can be received as criticisms. Criticisms are highly face-threatening act. So people can't really laugh at those things. And in his, I also used the example when he was performing the criticism, he tried to mitigate the face, threat by, making a joke. My beard almost fell on the ground. He said, "I lost face. We lost the face." That is referring to the Chinese concept because face is such an important concept in the Chinese culture. So he made use of that cultural source, but then he made a joke about it, and my beard almost dropped on the floor. But only one person laughed very briefly, and she stopped immediately because nobody was laughing. Because that shows the tension people realize. So that is also related to the content. That is the criticism of people there, isn't it? So to laugh with that would show affiliation with his stance. And the audience wouldn't want to affiliate with his stance because they have disagreement.
Well, if they risk that, right, they would be literally saying, or maybe not literally, but they're agreeing that the business has lost face.
Yeah, and what we did was wrong. Yeah. But they wouldn't want to accept that because they have differing views about the issues he raised. So
Disagreement. Sorry to interrupt, Duping. Yeah. But because, again, as you point out, this is a hierarchical meeting where the CEO is present, right?
Yeah.
So even if they privately agreed with Vincent in this case, to laugh with him sets them in opposition to the hierarchy that they're part of, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally agree. Because basically CEO is a decision maker. A lot of the things Vincent was criticizing was the decision of the CEO, the Chinese CEO. Yeah, that's also one of very important factors.
It's an incredibly complex situation, which is what I really enjoyed as well, that as I'm reading through and I'm thinking about this, there are all these various factors at play in what we see are reasonably small extracts, but we can rebuild the kind of situation because of the methodology.
Yeah. Listening to you two talk about this, and sort of dissect this and really start to find such rich meaning in this is, and this sort of example and this topic highlights how surprised I am in the paper when you talk about how laughter is something that is understudied, but that's quite different. You know, laughter as a practice have not. And also as well, you say that real life conflict interactions in general are understudied. And both of those areas as ones that have not been given so much attention surprise me very much.
One reason for the conflict study, one reason is because it's so hard to collect authentic conflictual data. When people are having a conflict, they'll try to do it
privately.
At least without letting other people to have the recording.
That makes perfect sense. And maybe they all don't have a lot of interns to transcribe it all.
There is some work that's been done on the affiliative nature of language, for example, in functional linguistics. But it's correct that especially in this kind of situation, you don't see a lot of it. And So I'm going to jump sideways here because I was approaching this on a number of different levels, not least of which is again this intercultural or cross-cultural aspect to it where, I mean, even a meeting itself, you point out, has almost different social purpose depending on which culture you're entering it in from, right?
Which purpose?
So you pointed out in the paper that the foreign or the international English teachers, English teacher managers were entering the meeting with the conceptual framework or the generic expectation that the purpose of the meeting was to solve problems or to, you know, work through these things. Whereas the Chinese staff don't enter the meeting with that set of expectations. Rather, any solutions that come about are via the hierarchical model.
This part, I call it the contextual level. Or the situational level. The CEO and his core management team played with this level. They're basically, they have been quite manipulative, at this level. They try to mislead the international managers to believe this is just one of those annual summary meetings where everybody will make a presentation for the whole organization, the major managers from different departments, to understand what is going on in each of the departments. So that's why they call this event an annual report seminar. But at the same time, they have a hidden agenda, the Chinese CEO and his team. That is to talk about the problems. Because the reason they played at this level, call it something, but actually doing something else, was because they didn't want to highlight the problems. If they call it a problem, they were worried that that will maybe escalate the tension and give people the impression that we are going into a meeting and start to fight.
Which happened anyway.
it happened anyway. And also that manipulation basically led to more misunderstanding because the problems they wanted to talk about was actually mainly related to Jack and Jack's program and Jack's behaviors, for example, in terms of inter-department cooperation. But they talked about these problems at Vincent's meeting. But each of the managers is going to make a present at a meeting. So this is called Vincent's meeting. So they talked about Jack's problems in Vincent's meeting. Of course, Vincent will be really angry because he kept saying this is not true.
How do you unpick all of these many layers to be able to focus on the function of laughter? Because it feels like there is so much going on.
Many things going on in a
conflictual meeting such as that. There's many different layers, as you just outlined in this way. So how do you actually manage to isolate laughter within that?
So, you know, before this paper, there was a monograph. In that research monograph, the whole monograph was used to analyze this meeting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Sorry, is this your former book, Intercultural Communication in the Chinese Workplace?
Yeah. So I used the whole book because I felt I couldn't describe what is going on and explain at different levels what happened. Basically, my question in that book was, what caused, isn't it? What caused the breakdown and why? So that whole book was used to,
So after you've sort of spent tens and tens of words, thousands of words going over it, then we can isolate laughter.
Although initially I was going to look at instances of laughter in several meetings. I only worked on one meeting in that book, but there are 20 more meetings, right? So when I was looking at other meetings, laughter, very interesting. So I started to select the instances, transcripts. Or we call it extracts of transcript, and isolate them, take them out, start to analyze. But when I tried to analyze them, I needed a system. Yeah. From different meetings, then there are different contexts, different functions. So in the end, I just decided, okay, maybe this time I'm going to still focus on this meeting because it's so, so interesting. There's already, one quite complete set of findings, by looking at the laughter, shared laughter in this one meeting. Yeah, so maybe in the future, but currently I'm not that interested in looking at laughter again.
Yeah, done that. I like the way we all laugh as a response to that. I'm now noticing when we laugh in this
podcast. See, this is the problem with linguistics. You start to get aware of all of these things that you're doing while you're trying to communicate, and you lose that kind of unconscious nature of it.
Yeah.
Don't worry, it'll go away quickly. We all become cured of it eventually. Quick question. I mean, I'm doing some work right now on simultaneous and consecutive interpreting in various types of situations as a multimodal act. And one of the things that we've noticed in digging through that kind of data is when participants are non-able to understand the source language or the target language, so depending on who they are, these type of cues can be very useful for cross-language affiliation. So when someone laughs, you know they're at least laughing, even if you don't understand the trigger or, you know, the particular meaning behind the utterance that caused that laughter. Do you think that there's much of that here? Because the CEO Wong, you were saying, has very limited English. And did the teachers, the international teacher managers, did they have much Chinese?
Similar level to Wong. Wong's English.
Okay. So those three participants are very limited in their ability to directly communicate.
Yeah. They have to communicate through an interpreter.
Except for the laughter, though, right? So as soon as there are those kind of paralinguistic cues or other sources like that, then they can view those, and at least they know that there's an attempt at that affiliation going on, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so.
Except with the laughing at, right?
Laughing at, nobody joined.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because, for example, one of them is a direct attack of the CEO. Nobody joined that one. Yeah. Others, I guess, when people feel it's a safe occasion, even sometimes when people can't see the reason for laughter, they would join, isn't it? It's a social activity. By joining the social activity, you are saying, I'm a member, and to indicate your belonging or try to belong to this group, I guess.
So here's my trick question, Du Ping. Is there any such thing as just laughing near?
What is...
So you have laughing at, right? So you're inside a complex discourse situation, and you can have more than one member targeting other members, which is the laughing at. Mm-hmm. There's the laughing with, which is whomever joins that group.
Mm.
But if you're a non-member of the laughing with or the laughing at, and if you're part of something else... I'm just curious, like, are there other examples of laughter taking place which aren't directly either at or with?
Oh, that's such an interesting question.
I could imagine people laughing near in an attempt to be part of the group.
Mm-hmm.
See that, trying to sort of ingratiate themselves into a group.
Or they are, maybe, I'm not talking based on evidence, but I'm just imagining maybe there are instances when people want to indicate that they don't join either side. Okay, there are two parties fighting with each other at meeting, but they want to, either they remain silent, but sometimes they maybe don't want to be that passive or don't want to be seen as so inactive. So maybe they're not So there are different ways of laughter, isn't there? Mm. There are genuine joy, laughing with, ha ha ha. But there may be, there could be other types of laughter as well.
Well, you indicate things like just smile voice or that, right? There's particular ways that we will affect our intonation or our language production simply because of mouth shape or, you know.
Yeah. If we really want to transcribe the sound of laughter, there's just probably thousands of different shapes, isn't it? Forms of.
I wonder if somebody somewhere has done that project.
I suspect, I mean, there's, I shouldn't be talking outside of my actual realm, but the idea of classifications of laughter are also, could include things like nervous laughter.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of ways that we actually do laughing, which aren't necessarily even affiliative in and of themselves, right?
Yeah.
So there can be, presumably types of laughter which are just totally inappropriate.
Mm. If we want to know these questions, probably we will need just to record a lot of social interactions in all kinds of different contexts, because it can only happen in the context, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And we can only interpret it and explain it in the context.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise, again, we're just doing these constructed examples. And
yeah, and also we have limited, limitations in our imagination as well. Now, if we want to come up, we can't. But in real life, they're just such rich evidence of different kinds of behaviors. Because people are just so interesting, so complicated.
They're way too complicated, yes. People are. They really are.
Therefore, they invented, created complicated ways to deal with the complicatedness of context.
You published the paper in 2022.
Mm.
So it's been out for a little while.
Yes.
Has there been any kind of response to the paper? Has there been any disagreement or any critique, or what kind of conversation has been started by this, do you feel?
I wish there, but I haven't seen direct criticisms. I've seen criticisms of my book, which I'm really happy about, because criticism means attention, isn't it? But this paper has been cited in a few quite interesting publications, including Cambridge Element book. I was very happy to see that. So I'm still waiting for responses, I guess. I hope when I look at some of the reviewers, I mean, after this is published, our faculty organized peer review processes, and I received 3 reviewers comment, and I was really, really happy to see those comments.
Mm. Well, that's good to hear, because I mean, it's strange to me that you would need to do that for the Journal of Pragmatics, because in obviously it's the top journal in the field of pragmatics, but with these strange ranking systems, you never know where it's going to end up.
Moving on.
Oh, yes, we can't talk about that. I get the awesome question, though. So you've mentioned that you may not concentrate on laughter as such. What will you be concentrating on? What are you working on now? What are your plans in the near future?
Basically, I started to work on laughter because I thought this is a small thing, so I will get this done and then I can start to do the real thing. but I didn't realize
the story of so many projects. Like, this will just be a little thing.
This rabbit hole looks extremely shallow.
Only laughter, right? I didn't realize the cost took me 2 years to actually finish it, and there's so much theoretical and methodological issues I need to deal with. But anyway, now what I'm working on is, I'm really interested in the actual meat, how disagreement is performed in conflictual interactions in intercultural workplace meetings.
Mm.
I'm interested in constructive and non-constructive disagreement. Because in the field of conflict study, conflict communication, people look at, conflict can be very constructive. It really depends on how people express disagreement in the process of the conflictual interactions, whether people can reach a constructive or destructive result.
Where are you planning to get your data for this?
I'm still working on my, remember I have 20 something more meetings to analyze. So what I'm doing is now I'm looking at instances of constructive disagreement and a non-constructive disagreement. These would be leading back to the area of study of conflict communication, because they usually work with surveys and interviews, asking people, what do you think? How do people conduct conflict constructively? But it's quite rare for people to look at real, authentic interactions, how people actually do it with language. So since I have the data, for example, there's some data here as well, then I can actually observe the linguistic or pragmatic strategies that I use to perform.
I can see Derek getting more and more and more.
Oh, I'm excited. I'm thinking to myself, part of the huge issue, of course, with self-report is that in a conflict, you've always constructed your own position, right?
Yes.
So it's never me that causes conflict, Mary. It's always the other person.
Mm. Let's hold that thought. Thank you very much, Deepak. We wish you all the best with your project. And I do hope you'll come back and tell us all about it.
Oh, thank you very much.
And
I really enjoyed this.
Analyze our behavior and how it has changed.
Oh, don't start analyzing the podcast. This is nice and fluffy work.
Thank you very much.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.